Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Fourth Estate Dungeon on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along for another Friday review of what happened, some of what happened, in North Carolina politics. As we begin, a programming note for you, because everything's fluid these days, right? We record our conversations generally on Thursday afternoon. So I asked Mitch Kokai and Rob Schofield about congressional maps, and it was prior to the final approval that they received. Just an FYI, full disclosure kind of thing. So as usual, a right and a left. We turn to each side for perspective. Rob Schofield from NC Policy Watch, the progressive organization, and Mitch Kokai from the conservative John Locke Foundation.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Congressional redistricting plodded along. Lawmakers ultimately approved a new map for the state's 13 U.S. House seats. Currently, a delegation of 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats. Well, the new electoral lines could give Democrats a chance of making this an 8-5 split, 8 Republicans, 5 Democrats. Remember, the current political maps were blocked for being illegal partisan gerrymanders. The courts could still weigh in on these new districts. Do you think they should?
It seems to me that this process with the congressional map has been a little less transparent, a little less satisfactory. I actually had problems with the legislative maps, but this process seems even worse. And it very much feels to me like it's sort of back to the future. It's, you know, even if they claim they're not using partisan information in drawing the maps, the map drawers have what you might call muscle memory. They remember. It's like if you asked me to rearrange the National League to favor my team or the National Football League to favor my team and put it in the right division, I could do that without probably looking at the history of who beat who. And I think it's sort of the same thing here. And League of Women Voters had a really excellent piece they put out this week in which they complained about just the whole process being non-transparent. So I think it's quite likely it's going to end up back in court. And it's too bad because we're still not where we need to get.
It is going to end up in court, and the judges are going to look at it. So that is going to happen regardless of whether they should or not. I think we try to read too much into this. I mean, you've got 13 districts. They've got to be of equal population and exactly equal population based on the last census. I mean, we're almost to a new census, but it's based on those old census numbers. And basically you have two counties, Wake and Mecklenburg, where you can fit a whole district within that county. You've got the triad where you can basically do two counties together and get a district. And then every other district is going to have to be a string of counties, and it's either going to be north, south, or east, west. The plans that they looked at all did a combination of both. Some looked like they were more north, south districts, some more east, west districts. You could choose one way or another to do it, and I think Rob is right to the certain extent that having seen the old maps, you kind of see whether it tends to go more east-west or north-south. But I think anyone who has not been involved in this process at all, hasn't paid attention, looked at the maps that were in front of them, either the ones the Democrats came up with or the ones that the Republicans came up with, and the only districts that they would say, this looks kind of weird, looks kind of funny, it would be largely because of the way county lines are or because of the districts where you don't have enough to fit within a county, and so there are some squiggles within a county, which might be because of a road or a body of water or something like that. So there can be political calculations going on, but the fact of the matter is there are only limited ways to draw a district in a strange shaped state like North Carolina that's going to fit 13 districts of exactly the same size population.
It's true, but there's more to it than just an eye test of looking to whether there's squiggles or not. I mean, there's just no doubt that they know what they're doing. The people have drawn these maps. The Republicans have drawn them. They know that they're trying to preserve as much advantage as they can. And it again brings us back to this point that this ought not to be done by the politicians who are doing this for themselves. and it's going to be a gerrymander. There's just no doubt that it's going to end up that way, and that's why I really think it would be a superior result if the court would just put a special master in charge and get us down and start moving our state in the road toward having truly independent redistricting.
Not trying to be a smart aleck. Have you ever seen a map that is not a gerrymander?
Sure.
A political map.
Sure. I think there are. I think they exist.
Can you point to one?
I mean, there are other states that have independent commissions, I mean, that have drawn their maps independently. I mean, I'm sure none of them are perfect, but it's clear that it's possible to put people in charge of this who don't have a vested interest in the outcome, who aren't running for those offices or who aren't, you know,
thinking
buddies,
about it in the future.
Yeah, thinking about running for a congressional office.
Well, Rob's group and I both agree that the process should be taken out of the hands of the General Assembly. I think there's still some debate about how to do that, whether it's an independent commission or legislative staff who are temporarily set up with some rules that guide them and restrict what they can do. But the General Assembly shouldn't be doing this.
When you say – just to jump in, when you say the General Assembly shouldn't be doing this, you mean specifically lawmakers.
The staff
work here at the General Assembly.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Meaning
the lawmakers. And basically, probably the way this would have to work is even if someone else does it, the General Assembly, the lawmakers themselves, would get an up or down vote on it unless there's another constitutional change that completely takes it out of their hands. And I think that would be problematic. But I think if you had some other group and give the legislature just an up or down vote, no amendments, that would probably solve a lot of the problem.
One of the elected officials directly affected by new districts is Congressman Dan Bishop. Listeners will remember the Republican won a special redo election in the 9th Congressional earlier this year. Bishop, who had served in both chambers of the state legislature, was the primary sponsor of House Bill 2. He today is an avowed President Trump supporter. On Monday night, he tweeted out the name of the whistleblower at the center of this entire impeachment inquiry. Struck me as undeniably an effort to discredit the whistleblower, be where you may on that issue of it. Wondering from each of you, was it legal and was it appropriate?
You know, the legality of it, I'm not sure. I don't know of anything that would make it illegal, but possibly there's something that prevents a member of Congress from taking that sort of action. In terms of the ultimate impact, I don't think there's going to be any because there is a very widely listened to conservative radio show in which the guy's name was mentioned many, many times. So it's not as if this is secret information. I don't think there's ultimately going to be any sort of outcome from Dan Bishop tweeting this that was not already accomplished by a major nationally known radio talk show host saying the name over and over again.
Should he have done it?
Probably not. But as I said, the name is out there. I think most mainstream media outlets have shied away from it, but certainly a lot of media outlets on the conservative side of the fence have been talking about the guy's name, putting out his picture. It's not a secret.
Just full disclosure, would that be Hannity or Limbaugh that you were just
I was going to say, I was talking about Limbaugh.
Okay.
Hannity may have too, but I was talking about Limbaugh.
Rob?
Yeah. Well, I actually think this is really a really terrible development. He is the first member of Congress to do this. It is clearly in violation of the whistleblower law and maybe some other federal national security laws as well. There's questions as to whether it's punishable or whether he could actually be subject to criminal prosecution. That's probably a long shot, but that doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it lawful. And it's just an outrageous step. I don't care if some irresponsible people are out there putting it out. For a member of Congress to – and it's frankly one of the first things he's done of even of note since he's been elected. He's missed half the votes or a large number of the votes in his first few weeks and months in Congress. To take such a step that – I mean, the bipartisan whistleblower law was something that was developed by Republicans and Democrats together. It's about protecting sort of the integrity of our government and – urging people who know about malfeasance to come forward. And this individual has obviously had multiple death threats already. Bishop adding his tweets to it. Frankly, Mitch, I don't know. I hadn't really been aware that Limbaugh had been putting it out there. I mean, I think this has having an effect. It's going to make a lot more people aware of this person's identity. And that's really, really reprehensible and a new level of reprehensible behavior by a member of Congress, in my judgment.
Do you worry about this? Go ahead.
I don't, and I think the amusing part to me about this is that the people from whom this whistleblower is likely to face some sort of problems are the people who already knew who he was, because they're the people who read conservative media, listen to Rush Limbaugh. The people who don't listen to the conservative outlets are the ones who wouldn't be endangering
him. Well, then Limbaugh ought to be prosecuted. I mean, I don't think there's anything amusing about it at all. I think it's putting a person's life in jeopardy and violating a federal law and a basic tenet of good government and of democracy. And I just think it's unbelievable. It's taking a real step towards despotism for a member of Congress to just blatantly flaunt the law and risk another human being's life who's trying to do something for their country.
That's overly dramatic to you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, welcome to what conservatives face from Antifa and all of the other crazy left-wing groups whenever they say anything. I mean, they're always targeted. I don't think there's going to be anything happening to this fellow. And whether Dan Bishop should have said anything about this is
one issue. Anybody
that
has to endure death threats on a national level, on a regular basis, something's already happened to them. That is an assault on an individual that Americans shouldn't have to endure that. We have a law. Chuck Grassley, the conservative Republican senator from Iowa, is one of the authors and champions of this whistleblower law. Even he came out and said that this is outrageous that we would release this person's name. And I just think that's where it's gone in this country. Maybe that's where right-wing talk. I don't know. Maybe you say it's where left-wingers are, too. I think they're both wrong. That is not the way Americans ought to behave. I think it's unpatriotic, and it's just a very dangerous step for our country.
State lawmakers did convene after a two-week hiatus. They worked on congressional boundaries, Hurricane Dorian disaster relief funding, and some transportation-related appropriations. Still, much left unaccomplished. What was the most notable thing legislators did not get to these past few days, Rob?
Most notable thing. Obviously, we could have had a vote to on the budget veto override in the Senate. Senator Jeff Jackson made a challenge to lawmakers before they even went home on this last break and said, we're all here. All 50 of us are here. Let's have the vote. Presumably, they could have done that again. We could then sit down and actually negotiate a final budget. We had a report from Moody's this week saying that it's endangering the state's bond rating and its economic well-being not to have a comprehensive budget in place. And I think that's the most obvious thing that continues to be the giant failure of 2019.
Yeah, the budget vote, and within that, probably the most obvious piece is teacher pay raises, and secondarily, Medicaid expansion. Those are things that were on the table that remain on the table because there's no agreement between the General Assembly and the governor.
And I also would note Medicaid transformation. We have this issue of expansion, but there's also transformation to, about 1.6 million people who are expecting to move under an area where they will receive managed care. And contracts have been signed. But my understanding of it, having done a little bit of reporting, is that there is not appropriation. There is not money to pay the private insurers because there is no budget. So lawmakers have exactly what's happening behind closed doors, we're not entirely sure. We thought we were going to see potentially an agreement this week on another effort to fund DHHS to restore some of the cuts that were going to go to HHS and also to fund Medicaid transformation. It would have been interesting to see how the governor would have handled that if he had gotten that bill. But that also, just from my vantage point, another 2 cents, something that did not get done this week was Medicaid transformation. Let's move on. We'll finish with 2020. Two interesting candidacies were announced this week. Mark Johnson, the Republican state superintendent, will not seek another term in that post. Instead, he's running for lieutenant governor. He joins a presently crowded field. Meanwhile, Wayne Goodwin, the chair of the state Democratic Party, will run for state insurance commissioner. He previously had held that post, was defeated in 2016. Now, what struck you about either of these announcements, Mitch?
Well, with Mark Johnson, it's interesting that he's only going to serve the single term, a tumultuous term. He had been fighting throughout his term with the State Board of Education. And one of the most interesting things about that to me is that it highlights just how bizarre our system is of running public education in North Carolina. Even Jim Blaine, the former top advisor to Phil Berger, came out shortly after Johnson's announcement and said, hey, this is the time, 2020, let's put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, get rid of the elected superintendent, get rid of the Board of Education, just make the Secretary of Education a cabinet appointee under the governor. Everyone thinks the governor runs state government anyway, so have the person who runs the education department be someone appointed to and accountable to the governor. And then you've seen some reaction to that, that, you know, maybe that's not the way to go, but something that, that changes this mess that we have now, where you have an elected superintendent, but the person has limited power because policy is really set by the state board. But the state board has really long appointments, so a new governor comes in and appoints people, but it may be 4 years into his or her term before he has enough appointments that he actually affects education policy. So I think that will really reignite this debate about how we run education. As for Wayne Goodwin, the thing that that is interesting to me is that after having served as a longtime legislator and then for 8 years, I believe, as the commissioner of insurance, he took a job as head of the state Democratic Party that's much more in your face, red meat to your crowd, whether you're the Republican leader or the Democratic leader, and now trying to step back into a more a role that's much less partisan or should be much less partisan.
Right. Or diplomatic.
Diplomatic. It'll be interesting to see whether that will be something that he's able to do. And, of course, it's going to be interesting to see a rematch. Mike Causey was a surprise winner in 2016. I don't think anyone expected him to win, and he did. Will he be a formidable opponent, or will people say, oh, you know, Wayne Goodwin, you know, we punished him last time, but we're putting him back in this time?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said. Mark Johnson and Causey, I think, are both sort of accidental victors in 2016. I think perhaps nobody thought either one would actually win. And you had these, you had Goodwin who had been in there, June Atkinson had been there for a long time and almost felt like, you know, this was a career job for them at that point. So Goodwin, it's perhaps a little understand. He's one of the rare candidates for lower tier office who maybe actually knows a little something about the job. A lot of people get run for these offices and you can see them just sort of shopping around for the one that they think they can win. They may or may not have experience. I mean, Johnson and was an example of someone like that who had very limited experience in the education world and I think has pretty much found himself in over his head most of the time in the job and sort of, you know, it's clear that he wasn't in it. He was fighting with people the whole time. He's never had much support, and I'm not surprised that he's looking for something else, although I think he'll have an uphill battle to win the lieutenant governor's race. Goodwin, I think there's a, probably an element of the Democrats who would rather have maybe a fresher face running for that office, maybe somebody new. Goodwin, there were questions asked about the whole mess with Robin Hayes and the Greg Lindbergh mess, and, you know, I think that that there will probably be some questions at some point he needs to answer. But for the most part, with these lower-tier Council of State offices in a presidential election year, everything else on the ballot, they don't get a whole lot of attention. So I suppose candidates are banking on, you know, what's going to happen at the top of the ballot, really controlling their races.
All right, a factoid, and then going to ask each to just entertain me on a theory I have. The factoid is there were 19 statewide races, partisan statewide races in 2016. 15 were won by Republicans. Three were won by Democrat, if a Democratic candidate, if I do off the top of my head, Governor Roy Cooper, Attorney General Josh Stein, and Auditor Beth Wood. The other race that was won by a Democrat was Mike Morgan, who was up for a state Supreme Court seat. He beat the incumbent Bob Edmonds, but it is very much worth noting that there was not an R or a D versus next to either of their names.
And Morgan's name was on the spot where, for other judicial races, the Republican was.
Very important note. Okay. So that's just – as we think about statewide races, it was very healthily – it was a very healthy Republican year in 2016. Here's my theory. As we think about Johnson getting into this lieutenant governor's race, he is now, I believe, one of eight Republicans. There are five Democrats there. And you think the lieutenant governor doesn't have very much power. What would give the lieutenant governor a lot of power? An even Senate, 25-25, and a lieutenant governor could potentially become a key figure in North Carolina politics. That is one of the worthless things that I – maybe worthless things that I kick around in my brain these days. What do you make of that theory?
Well, the fascinating thing is that the lieutenant governor used to be very powerful in North Carolina. They used to really run the Senate. And then when a Republican was elected, the Democrats said, we think we'll put that power in the Senate president pro tem. And then a Democrat got elected and they said, I think we're going to keep it in the Senate president pro tem. We don't want to give it to Dennis Wicker, who was the lieutenant governor back in the 90s. So that's an interesting theory. It sounds like a bit of a long shot, but be fascinating to see. I think most people run for lieutenant governor because they figure it's a stepping stone to something else. It's a great job. You get a little bit of a staff. A nice office. You don't really have any duties or responsibilities, and you can take the bully pulpit. I mean, basically, that's what Dan Forrest has done for 8 years. He's gone around and given campaign speeches and been running for governor the whole time.
Yeah, and you know, one of the unforeseen consequences of the loss of power for the lieutenant governor is the huge rise in power for the president pro tem of the Senate, because it was around that same time that the Democrats who ran the General Assembly got rid of the power of the Republican lieutenant governor, that Mark Basnight came in and started his 18-year run as the head of the Senate, and really at times seemed to be the most powerful person in state government, which you could say for the decade is Phil Berger, who succeeded Basnight as the president pro tem of the Senate. So I'm guessing no one really saw that that was going to happen, that by taking away the lieutenant governor's power, that the president pro tem of the Senate would be arguably, if the person could maintain that office for a while, the most powerful person in government.
I don't think it's so arguable that the head of the Senate is the most powerful person in politics. Anyway. Mitch Kokai is senior policy analyst at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Thanks, guys. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you.
Jeff.
You can read and listen to more coverage about the new congressional districts, what it means for a couple of incumbents, and also perhaps litigation, further litigation that awaits. You can get more context at our website from some of the reporting my colleague Rusty Jacobs has done, also some of the reporting that I've done this week as well. Glad to have you along, as always, for the WUNC Politics Podcast. Do me a favor. Feel free to give us a rating and or a review. Encourage one of your friends or neighbors or colleagues to listen as well. Twice a week now, long-form conversations early, wrap-up of the week's news later, usually on Fridays. For Mitch and Rob, my name is Jeff. We'll talk to you again soon.